Hello, this is Dan Lebatard, and one of the things that I've gotten into recently is just watching documentaries that enlighten me on subjects with a lot of factual subject matter. And I know that documentaries don't necessarily always tell the truth, and maybe sometimes just tell a director's version of the truth. But even as a lifelong studier of sports and feeling like I know the conditions that we're watching in amateurism, Pat Condellis did a documentary for HBO called The Scheme, in which you can't help but notice how silly and stupid the system is in working against somebody who's just a middle managing businessman who then really, really gets royally screwed. And you just see how the machine works, how the sausage is made. And I found it fascinating. He's very good on the subject. And you don't have to watch the documentary, because what we're about to cover here is going to give you a good look at the inner workings of the big sports machine. But I suggest you watch the documentary, again, The Scheme on HBO, because it is illuminating. It is humanizing. And here is a Cliff Notes version for you in the event that you do want to watch the documentary. Here's Pat Condellis. Again, he did some good work here. It's thorough and it's interesting. So Pat Condellis, the director, is with us now. And I guess on the front end, what I would ask you to tell the audience, Pat, is exactly why did you enter the wanting to do of this movie?
I mean, the main reason was, I mean, the story was incredible. I you know, heard it like everybody else did when the press conference came out and the announcement was made that the FBI had engaged in this 3-year undercover investigation. And I thought, man, how many coaches are they going to take down from this? What's going to happen? And then nothing happened. So I really didn't think too much about the story or the case or anything that I had heard of it previously until Peter Nelson of HBO Sports gave me a call and we started discussing it. And then I met Christian, and Christian was really the reason why I wanted to do this, because he was the centerpiece of this investigation. He became the quote unquote kingpin, right, of this. And he was such a fascinating guy, and he was so much different than I think the way that I had imagined him to be based on all these articles that I had read about him. His perspective was just amazing. And it was such an insane story. I mean, if you wrote it, you would be accused of being too sensational, you know, making up a story like this. So,
well, when you read about him, because I could see how in your mind or in anybody's mind, if you read about this character, what you might jump to is, oh, seedy agent, underbelly. But this dude wasn't merely a hustler, though he was a hustler. This dude had figured out how to game the system in a way that was kind of within the boundaries of whatever the established ethics of the sport were. Like, this was not some dirty scumbag. This was a guy who just learned basketball in the AAU world and managed to profit on it. And it's why I thought the documentary was so compelling, because somebody got crushed under the machine that was just doing business better than most.
Better than most. And I mean, it was from Christian's perspective, I think he was surprised at the reaction to this, because this was a normal operation. In his mind, he wasn't doing anything that was really any differently than anybody else. He was just maybe a little bit more successful at a much younger age than everybody else was in this world. But, you know, like the idea that players were getting paid, he thinks is such an absurd question, you know, and like his response in there to when I say like, hey, was Andy Miller paying players? He's like, what are you talking about? He's been paying players for 20 years. Like, this isn't a secret. This is how this works. You know, and like he said, it's the cost of doing business. So from their standpoint, I mean, it's looked at as literally just overhead, operational cost, right? And it's a risky, risky business model. That's the other thing about this. You're paying arguably substantial amounts of money to kids at a very young age, hoping, one, that they make it. Right, that they can make it to the NBA draft, and then hoping too that they don't turn around and screw you at the last minute and go with another agent, because there's no contracts here, right? So the whole thing is a very entrepreneurial situation, and it's a risk. So the stuff that these agents and these runners and everybody are doing, they're casting out a wide net, right, among these players, hoping that this is all going to pay off down the line, and there's no guarantees that any of that is going to work out.
What preconceptions did Christian Dawkins rectify upon meeting you?
a Christian is incredibly smart. He is highly intelligent. He did some stupid things in this, but I was amazed at his intelligence. I was amazed at how he's like a walking encyclopedia when it comes to the basketball world. I mean, Christian knows every player that played in a bench school in the Midwest, every assistant coach, every agent. I mean, he is truly a savant in this. And I was impressed with his work ethic, and getting to know his backstory with his family was very, very interesting. And I think at that context, you can see him in a more accurate light when you know about his family history, when you know about his dad and the coaching world, and you can see how at a very, very young age, this was something that informed him from, five, 6 years old, this is basketball.
No, I thought that was one of the excellent nuances and context that you offered to the story by pointing out how someone gets the imprinting to become the person that he did. And the reason that I found it fascinating is because the entire system fell on only his neck, not just the stupidity of the NCAA system, not just the stupidity of this secret underbelly that college sports has of paying players, but then the FBI also failed him, because I thought that the behavior of the FBI here was just, it's damn near incompetent.
Yeah. Well, it's incompetent, but it's also crooked. I mean, the fact that multiple agents here were alleged to have stolen money from this investigation, I know that one of them was fired, because that was confirmed in a letter from June Kim, who was the interim U.S. attorney for the Southern District. But in the courtroom, there was discussions of 5 out of the 7 FBI agents that were actually implicated in this. So at the end of this, you're like, wait a second, they're talking about spending hundreds of thousands of dollars in Vegas here, right? Gambling and partying and doing all this stuff. And there's allegations that the FBI stole money from this investigation. And again, if you compare that to what Christian was convicted of and what he was ultimately arrested for, he was giving people money, right? You're giving somebody money in the hopes that they give you their business if and when they make it, as opposed to Marty Blazer, who steals $2.3 million from somebody and gets probation, or as opposed to the FBI agents that are allegedly stealing money from this and aren't going to jail themselves. So the whole situation is so absurd. You ask yourself, like, wait, how is it that Christian Dawkins is the one that got the longest sentence in all of this?
Tell the people who haven't seen the documentary, Marty Blazer, who was he?
So Marty Blazer is a fascinating character himself, and he is really the origin of this entire undercover FBI investigation. And that comes about because Marty Blazer worked in the football world. He was a financial advisor for some NFL athletes, and one of the big ones that we name in there was Lamar Woodley, who was the former linebacker of the Pittsburgh Steelers, who was from Saginaw. And right, so Christian already had a connection with Lamar Woodley, who kind of vouched for Marty Blazer, and I think that's how they had met. But Marty Blazer gets indicted by the SEC for all sorts of fraud schemes that he's doing with his client's money. And when he gets busted for that, he basically says, "Don't arrest me. I know about a scheme here where these players are getting paid, and I think we can maybe wrap up some coaches in here as well." So that begins the entire case. It's a guy that was a fraudster that is trying to get himself out of trouble, and he's trying to hook bigger fish for the FBI. And they give this thing their blessing. And at the beginning of this, this is Marty Blazer going out there trying to initiate fake deals and record people on his own without the FBI. We play the first call that he has that was recorded between him and Christian Dawkins. And he's trying to say, like, hey, let's do this. Let's get into business together. The whole thing, he's trying to set up everybody he knows in this world. And that was the origin of this entire investigation, which is mind-boggling.
Do you have any good, solid theories or reporting on the backstory of why the FBI would choose this as a crusade, given what you just said, that it's basically just a fraudster trying to, grant himself some immunity?
The only thing that makes sense to me is that, whoever signed off on this to move forward with this investigation and spend these kind of resources is that they hoped at the end of it they could have an amazing press conference right, and bring down some really big name coaches. That's the only thing that makes sense. And even that is not a great explanation for why they would go ahead and do this. I mean, the funny thing about this is, too, it's like, this is seemingly a victimless crime. If you're giving somebody money in the hopes that they're going to turn around and do business with you later, I mean, that's advertising, right? I mean, this is ridiculous. So they had to invent a victim in this, and for them, for the Southern District and the FBI to say that these schools and these massive institutions are actually the victim is crazy. But to your question, I think the only reason they really did this was so that they could say, hey, we got Hall of Famer Rick Pitino. He pled guilty in the Southern District, right? We got big name coaches that we took down and got convictions of.
So you have this situation where basically the FBI is volunteering because of a fraudster to become the security arm for the NCAA on rules enforcement. So I ask you this question. In everything that you did with this reporting, and how long were you working on this? How long were you working on this?
A little over a year.
And how many people did you talk to during this?
I mean, dozens.
Okay. With that as the backdrop, tell me what the FBI was most from among these three. Incompetent, corrupt, or dumb?
That's a tough question. I think, look, we know, we can't prove necessarily how corrupt they were because that information is being covered up and that's not being allowed to come out. So I would say probably incompetent. I mean, they didn't understand, very clearly they did not understand the world of college basketball and recruiting world. They didn't, the whole business model that they tried to put forward of paying the coaches, that was purely to get the quote unquote bribery charge, right? And when the people that are actually working in this world are trying to explain to them, like Christian and Merle Code and others, saying, this doesn't work. You don't pay coaches because the coaches aren't trying to force talent out the door. You know what I mean? It doesn't really make sense here to do it this way. They didn't get that. And I think it's a combination of them not understanding how it works and also not caring, because they're trying to meet the legal threshold here where they can say that this is a federal crime. And I think they were more concerned about that than anything else. So I would say incompetence, but dumb and corrupt are close seconds.
Okay, so then for those who haven't seen the documentary, and I urge you guys to watch it, because no matter how much we talk about it here, there's subtlety and nuance and context in it that you need. It's The Scheme on HBO. Christian Dawkins, what was his penalty? What should his penalty have been? It almost goes without saying, right, that unless you're going to indict the entire system, he shouldn't have had any penalty.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think they ultimately wanted Christian to be the guy at the end of this that had the longest prison sentence. So they charged him with 10 felonies across two federal trials. He was convicted of 3 out of 7. That in itself is a staggering blow to the conviction rate of the Southern District of New York, who operates on roughly a 97% to 99% conviction rating. So the fact that they only convicted on 30% of the charges that they brought is amazing. And I don't think they wanted to even arrest Christian. I think they wanted him to wear a wire. They wanted him to get Rick Pitino, Sean Miller, some of these other coaches, Andy Miller, his former boss, get them on tape. And then they would, you know, have Christian testify like everybody else did in this. But Christian, of those three charges that he was convicted of, got 18 months total in federal prison. He's out on appeal on both of those now. But if he loses his appeal, he will serve 85% of that sentence in prison.
Pat, one of the things that I've been amazed by, because I thought for sure, because of that success rate on federal indictments once the charges get brought, I thought for sure that this was going to be a seismic game changer, that that coaches weren't going to be able to weasel around it. The idea that a federal indictment would be this flimsy and ignorant and incompetent and corrupt and dumb, I don't have a precedent for it. You know what I mean? Like, because the conviction rate, as you mentioned, as soon as this came down, I thought, oh my God, college basketball is going to collapse under this. What do they have?
Right. And, you know, there are so many things that happened, Dan, in these two cases that we couldn't get into in the documentary because it just wasn't time. But I mean, it was, watching this whole thing unfold was incredibly depressing and disappointing from a criminal justice standpoint. I went to the sentencing of the first trial, and it, like, walking into the federal courtroom was almost like there was this unspoken agreement between everybody that walked in there, like, hey, we're going to pretend like reality doesn't exist here, and you're now kind of entering this weird twilight zone, you know, and I'm listening to a Southern District prosecutor stand up in front of a packed courtroom and say, this has damaged the reputation of Louisville so much, Your Honor. You know, they were, had that first Rhodes Scholar. They have such an impeccable reputation of being this incredible higher education institute. And the damage that these defendants have done is so, you know, basically lobbying for a maximum prison sentence, literally of years for these guys. And the judge even said, to be fair, they just had a prostitution scandal the year before this happened. You know, but in the second trial, I was there every day in the second trial, and it was unbelievable to watch how the system works. The jury never knew, right, that there was allegations that the FBI stole money. The defense attorney subpoenaed Sean Miller, Will Wade, and Jeff D'Angelo, who was the undercover. The federal prosecutors blocked all of those from coming in the courtroom. They argued against it. The judge agreed with them. So even when the defense attorneys would say to the jury, ask yourselves why the lead investigative agent, the undercover FBI agent, is not here in the courtroom, I think they said that enough that the prosecutors were worried that this was actually starting to influence the jury, that right before they went in to deliberate, they lobbied the judge for a jury instruction to say, like, hey, the defense had every opportunity to call the FBI agents, and they just didn't. Which was a bold-faced lie. They weren't even allowed to interview them, much less call them in. And the judge agreed. This is a federal judge with a lifetime appointment that looked at the jury and lied and said these defense attorneys could have called these undercover FBI agents. They just chose not to. And that was...
Why'd he do that?
I don't know. It was jaw-dropping. It was amazing. It was like... It was like the prosecutor seemed to get worried right before the end of this thing, and they did everything they could to guarantee these convictions, and it was shocking. I mean, there's all of these things I think are being brought up and argued on appeal right now, but for any person that sat in that courtroom and watched that, you're like, what the hell is going on here?
This
is
I feel like you just explained how the indictment rate so often results in conviction. If you're talking about judges being in cahoots with lawyers, right? If a judge is going to lie in a courtroom,
you can't win. You can't win. I mean, you go in there. It's why so many people plead guilty right away. Because if you don't, if you fight it, which Christian Dawkins did fight it, Merle Code fought both as well. I mean, Merle Code wasn't even in the room when any of these quote-unquote bribes happened. He's not even there. And they brought charges because he wouldn't plead. They went after him harder. They went after Christian harder to punish him when he wouldn't plead guilty. And Christian Dawkins, to my knowledge, is the only defendant that testified in his own defense. So he sat up there for days. And, I mean, the cross-examination that went on, I mean, I wish we could have had cameras in there. It was unbelievable. I mean, you had a Southern District of New York prosecutor that was almost swallowing the microphone. He was screaming at the top of his lungs at Christian Dawkins, who's sitting there on the stand. Hey, Christian sat back at one point and said, relax, bro. You know, to this prosecutor, the whole jury broke out laughing. I mean, so the fact that this kid, who's 25, 26 years old, said, I'm not going to testify against anybody else. I'm not going to roll. I'm not going to help you get any other convictions. I'm not going to plead guilty. I'm going to fight, and I'm going to give you a crack at me on the stand, on the witness stand. He did all of that, which is amazing.
And at the end, he gets wronged. At the end, he gets f***ed, like, completely in every way. My guess is that he had that kind of confidence going in because he kind of knew that he hadn't really done anything wrong, but I think he vastly underestimated if a federal government can bring or get a conviction with the help of a judge, like you're saying, he's vastly underestimating how much being right matters when the people on the other side are just trying to make sure the system is right.
Yeah, being right doesn't matter at all on this. It doesn't matter at all. And they're operating on such an unlevel playing field in a federal courtroom. The judge, when they sentenced them to the second trial, the same judge that told the jury that the defense attorneys have the right to call the FBI agent, scolded Christian for testifying. Said, you did yourself no favors. And you're sitting there going, what do you, everybody's got a right to defend themselves here. This is America. What are you doing? The message that's being sent here very, very clearly and very loudly is don't f*** with the Southern District. Don't f*** with the FBI. If you get charged, you better play ball or we're going to come after you. And that is incredibly disheartening and incredibly eye-opening, I think, to watch this whole story unfold. And
well, how naive were you? Like, because I'm curious, what are some of the things that were happening in that courtroom that it most hurt you to not have for the documentary? Because if you put it in front of people, they would clearly be appalled.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that we didn't have is the other wiretaps that the FBI got of these coaches. And I don't, I've been told things that were on some of these wiretaps and I can't corroborate that. So, you know, I don't know how many there were. I don't know exactly what's on there. I've been told that the stuff that they have is far worse than what we were given and what we played in the documentary.
Well, what can you say though? Like understanding on the front end, offering all the qualifiers and you're being a responsible journalist, you're saying you don't have corroborations on these things and therefore you didn't use them. But with that as qualifier and diluter, what are we talking about?
I've been told that there's far more damning evidence of that these coaches are talking about, you know, specific payments to these players. And I think, look, I think any objective person, when you hear the free calls that we put in the documentary that were never played in a courtroom and had never been played publicly before, it's very, very clear what they're talking about. Very, very clear. I mean, Will Wade, if you listen to Will Wade and Christian Dawkins, Christian says about four words in that entire conversation. Right, he's listening to Will Wade emphatically say the offer that I made was so incredible. You know, it was such a strong ass offer. You know, and it was tilted towards the family. So he says, "What do you think?" to Christian. He's trying to get Christian's help and advice in this situation, and then goes on to say, "Look, like I've made you know easier offers than this for a lot better players." It's amazing. It's amazing that those guys not only were they not charged. They never were even interviewed by the FBI, to my knowledge. And then when the stated objective here is to take down big name coaches, and this is why they spent so much money, so much time on this whole investigation, that they are the ones that prevented those coaches from coming in, and they are working to block their own evidence that they gathered in this case. That's staggering. It's unbelievable to me, right? The reason that we put those calls in there was not to try to get Sean Miller or Will Wade fired. Who cares? You know, assume that they're all paying players and that's fine. But it's to show that these guys were caught on FBI wiretaps and they were treated very, very differently than the defendants in these two cases. And the question is why? Why did that happen? And we were never able to answer it, unfortunately.
What else would you say happened in that courtroom that you couldn't film and therefore couldn't be in the documentary that you think would have bolstered it even more?
There's a discussion about how many FBI agents were accused of stealing money. I would have liked to get more information on that. We tried to get the Department of Justice to confirm whether or not there was actually this one of the cases had been pushed forward for prosecution and what the status of that was, and they never responded to that.
Do you have an amount that theorized that the FBI agents lost, and do you have how they got that money? Like what was happening here in terms of corruption?
They were dealing with cash, and there was so much cash. I mean, like Kristen said, you know, in the safe that they had at the Vegas penthouse was well over $100,000 in cash. Just on that. So, I mean, they give them $50,000 in cash, $25,000. I can't remember what the amount is on the boat. So, I mean, they had cash everywhere. And I've been told, again, I can't verify the numbers and I don't know, but I know, you know, some of the defense attorneys hired private investigators to go to Vegas and try to retrace the steps and see how much was actually spent. And I mean, I've heard things about what was allegedly spent with them just gambling, and they're staggering numbers. And again, I can't corroborate that. But there's no doubt they had tons of opportunity to blow through hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash in this whole thing.
You thought, or you said earlier, that you were sad. You kept getting sad. I imagine angry too, no?
I've covered lots of cases, criminal cases from disgrace. There was all sorts of shady things that happened in that prosecution as well. I mean, there's other stories that we're working on that are the same. It's just disappointing that at every level of the criminal justice system, you just get the same thing kind of over and over and over again. There's always something corrupt that's gone on, something shady that's gone on. It's not handled the way that I think most Americans would like to think that it is. And you're, at least from my perspective, I'm constantly waiting to find somebody do the right thing. And it's very, very rare that that happens when you start examining these cases.
You didn't exactly walk into this naive, right? So for you to find it appalling and sad and angry, it's not like you walked into that courtroom one time not knowing how some of this shit works.
Yeah, I mean, but look, I was naive in the sense that when we started getting the evidence and started looking at everything, and I'm sitting there through that courtroom, I'm like, man, there's no way they're going to convict. There's no, this whole thing is reasonable doubt. Like, what are we talking about here? And so to see how the prosecutors and the judge are able to tweak this thing and rule on certain things and basically mold a case or a trial to their liking so that the majority of a jury can go back and say, yeah, we agree with you. That was shocking. I mean, because the jury was smart. The jury pool that they had in Manhattan was amazing. I mean, it was shocking. I sat there, watched through the jury selection, and they were highly intelligent individuals. And I'm like, you listen to some of these wiretaps, it's blatant reasonable doubt. But the fact that they still got convictions on three charges, I was naive. I didn't think that was going to happen.
In terms of things that you're proud of shining a light on with this documentary, I imagine explaining to us how we get to that 97% federal conviction rate had to be pretty high up there. I imagine also the way that the white guys got away with everything and the black guy middle manager did not would be very high. But how would you rank them in terms of the pride you had in being able to establish an argument, shining a light on some things that are obviously important beyond basketball and beyond the paying of players?
Yeah, I think for us, the objective was really the biggest challenge and the biggest thing that we wanted to achieve in this is we wanted to lay this out in a way that the audience, whether they follow sports or not, could comprehend and digest this information and understand so that they get the full context at every stage of this, right? You get the context of Christian before he gets involved in this. Then it's clearly laid out how this business works, how the business model works. And then the origin of the investigation into the most important part of this, I think, is all of those wiretap calls so that you can hear for yourself the unvarnished, unedited take and the really get a true sense of intent and motivation with this. So I think what we wanted to do was kind of cut back all of the bullshit and say, get in the room as the audience, get on the phone, listen to how this went down, and then make your own assessment of who you think is dirty, who you think is shady, right? And then hopefully at the end of that, you will ask some questions relating to some of the topics that you brought up, right? The selective prosecution, the role that race played in this, and if these rules are antiquated and outdated.
Have you actually been able to help Christian Dawkins, or are you caught up in the same system? You're pointing out the story to everyone. You're sitting here saying you're part of the appeal. Have you been able to help him or not yet?
No. And I think my motivation was not to necessarily help him, but, you know, was to try to break down what actually happened in this. And Christian.
No, but I understand, but I'm saying he's gone to appeal. Part of the way that injustice gets exposed, I mean, hell, we've seen that, you know, Bill Cosby ends up getting, becoming a prisoner late in life because of a Hannibal Buress routine. Like,
right.
I don't mean that you actively intended to help him. I'm saying, has the documentary helped him?
Oh, I think it has tremendously. Yeah, the court of public opinion, I think absolutely. Because look, from everything that I read before I met him, I mean, it was so negative and so slanted against him. I mean, he was portrayed as being this dirty, dirty, greedy guy. And I mean, when you look at it objectively, there's no example that we could find of him screwing over everybody to advance himself or to put more money in his pocket. So yeah, I think this has helped him, at least in the court of public opinion. I don't know if it's going to really have any impact on his appeals. that's, I think, yet to be seen. And, you know, how would we even know that anyway? I mean, even if he wins an appeal, I think there's probably pretty strong legal arguments there whether this doc is made or not.
It's just jarring, though, to have just throughout the process, you say how you go into it, reading about it, and so negative. It's so very jarring to watch something and have the villain be the closest thing to a hero that you find in the whole thing. It's weird. Like, it's a weird viewing experience, because that is a dude that has been villainized for basically just doing work better than most in a really cutthroat, greedy, dirty game that's a lot dirtier than he actually seemed to have been.
Yeah, absolutely. And Christian sat there and you know, basically threw himself out there to be judged in this. And he was asked very difficult questions. I pushed him. This was not me lobbing softballs at him. And he did what almost everybody else refused to do. I mean, we reached out to the FBI, Mark Emmert, a representative from the NCAA, when he sued Marty Blazer, Southern District, June Kim, you know, Merle Coe, Jim Gatto, everybody. Nobody wanted to go on camera and talk about this. And nobody wanted to get asked a really difficult question that, you know, I'm sure they really didn't want to answer. Christian did. And, you know, the amazing thing about it is he still doesn't think he did anything wrong, right? He did some things that I think you could say, look, like, you know, you were cutting corners, you were breaking rules, you know, all of this is kind of shady, but this is how it works as well, right? Like, you're not going to get ahead in that business if you're not doing that. So, look, I think he deserves credit for putting himself out there and for answering difficult questions. And again, he was a guy that didn't roll, he didn't rat anybody out, and he didn't testify against anybody else. And he did this all in his early 20s, where if you look at these other co-defendants, these are guys that are you know, in their 40s, you know, that are very successful guys that are ratting on a kid in his early 20s, you know, to save themselves.
What did it hurt the most to leave out? What was on the cutting room floor that just couldn't get in there for time reasons, or something that you wanted badly to get in there, but it just, you couldn't?
There was a lot more that we had initially in there on the race theme and what had happened there, right? And if you start to break it down. And unfortunately, we couldn't put a lot of that in there. We tried to be strategic in the mentions that we have, because a lot has been done on that and a lot has been said on that previously. So we didn't really want that to dilute the main, you know, part of the story that we thought was new, but we still wanted it in there. We could do 2 to 3 more parts on this thing easily, but the race thing was glaring. I mean, if you look at all the assistant coaches are black, all of their bosses were white, you know, all of them went down. I mean, you know, the one thing that's been surprising to me is, like, look at Tony Bland in this. That's an example I honestly thought was going to get a little bit more attention, because Tony Bland pled guilty. He never touches the money in the video. You see the video of Jeff D'Angelo, the FBI agent, put the cash on the table, and blatantly in front of him, Christian Dawkins picks it up, puts it in his pocket. Tony Bland, there's no evidence whatsoever that he touched a dollar of that money. He has never shown on camera. He's never on a wiretap talking about that money. And he pled guilty, right? He's a convicted felon. And there's video evidence that we put in here of him not taking money. And it's, again, it's evidence that can be corroborated by what Christian's saying. Christian's like, Tony didn't get it. I get it. You see the video. Christian picks it up. And the FBI agent even hands him the envelope. So the FBI agent knows that Tony Bland didn't touch the money. And, I mean, that's amazing. And, you know, Tony, we reached out to him too. He didn't want to talk. And I think that's unfortunate, because I think a lot of these guys, Book Richardson, Merle Code, Tony Bland, I think they could have added a hell of a lot to the documentary if they would have talked.
Man, I would have liked to have seen that documentary. I feel like that's like 6 parts. I feel like that's the movement we're headed toward. Netflix is headed toward, you can watch these things grow over 2, 3, 4 episodes, and next thing you know, you've got an 8-hour or a 10-hour movie. That right there would have resonated even more, because I'm guessing you would have been able to get into that labyrinth and produce at least a second episode that would have felt just as strong and would have been sort of more societally damning when you see how cursed the system is.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a joke, and it's, you know, it's like, you know, I did a documentary a couple of years back called Disgraced on the Dave Bliss, Baylor basketball, the murder and all the things that happened with that. And that was a perfect example of Dave Bliss is still coaching to this day. Abar Rouse was the assistant coach who's black. He's the hero. He's the one that exposed all of this. He was blackballed from the industry and never allowed to coach again. And you see it in this case. You see all of these assistant coaches that all went down, had their names dragged through the mud. Probably most of them are in financial ruin at this point, right? But all of the head coaches don't so much as get interviewed. You have two head coaches that can be caught on an FBI wiretap discussing deals for players, and they're still making multi-million dollar a year salaries. And it's staggering. I mean, it's the optics of this are god awful.
Well, I can't believe that I'm talking to somebody, again, for those of you who don't know the reference that he's making there, I'm talking to somebody here who is jaded by Dave Bliss and a story that had murder in it, and yet you're still walking into a courtroom and being jarred. That's crazy, because you are not a novice here. The idea that you've already seen what murder looks like up close and how it is that the people are protected on murder, and that this would still jar you and make you angry and sad. Good God, dude.
Yeah, it's like, here's another example, right? You have LSU and Arizona have come out and made statements that Will Wade and Sean Miller are good, right? Like, we're not going to, there's no change to their employment. That to me is the best possible example of how ludicrous the government's theory is that the schools were victimized, right? And if you don't have a victim, you don't have a crime, you know? So the fact that LSU and Arizona are saying, we're cool, this is good, no problem here, guys, it shows you how insane this whole theory was from the get-go. These schools are not, they clearly don't feel like they were victimized. They clearly are blessing this and saying, hey man, like, look, this is what we're willing to do to win. You know, and the head coaches get the benefit of the doubt for whatever reason, where the black assistant coaches clearly do not.
Pat, really appreciate your time here. And it's an extraordinary piece of work. You should check it out. HBO, The Scheme. Even if you think you know sports, this is the dirty underbelly of a lot of different things in society and America that are adjacent, sports adjacent, but much bigger than that. Appreciate what it is that you did, and appreciate the time, sir. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dan. It was a pleasure.
Our thanks there to Pat Condellis. Again, check out The Scheme on HBO if you want to know more about that subject. It's in there pretty deep in terms of making you understand what the hell you're watching when it comes to the big business of sports. A reminder here that the radio show, if you wish to support all of this other content that we're giving you, we've told you before that what they're paying for us at ESPN to do is the 2 hours of national radio and Highly Questionable. Everything else that we're giving you here, all the other podcasts, the Big Suey, the Local Hour, the Postgame Show, all of that we're doing because we know our fan base wants the radio show, the thing that we do best, the goofy chemistry of the radio show. Lebatard and Friends is one thing that you could support, but support the radio show, download it, rate, subscribe, and review so that we can get some help in terms of boosting those numbers there to a place where we can concentrate on continuing to give you free content. The next South Beach session is going to be with Boog Shambi. It has been weird in baseball this year, and it's been weird broadcasting the games. There's some good stuff in that one. Look forward to you hearing that. That'll be the next South Beach session. Talk to you then.